You're listening to a sermon by Brianna Russell, recorded on Sunday, February 16th, 2025, at Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Friends, I'm going to put a timer on because brevity is not my superpower. And so sometimes I risk going over. So I'm going to put on my timer here just so we can make sure that you can hold me accountable and I can hold myself accountable. Rosie invited me to speak, is true. However, the way it actually happened is she invited my boss, CEO of Sanctuary Mental Health Ministries, Daniel Whitehead, to speak to you this morning. And I understand that he's spoken here before, so there's a little bit of history there. Dan is incredibly busy right now, and so he suggested to Rosie that I come in his stead. And when Rosie approached me, I was delighted. In my own faith tradition, women aren't welcome to speak from the pulpit. And so I do a lot of speaking at churches who open their doors and invite me in with such hospitality that it always warms my heart. So I was really excited to come to you today. What I would like to share with you today is from those two scripture readings that we read, but also in the methodology and even the pedagogy of the way that Sanctuary approaches things, is to begin a little bit with a piece of my own story, my own lived experience, so that you get to know me a little bit more and the view with which I come to you to share. I should mention that I am not a psychologist. Do we have any psychologists in the room? Any psychiatrists?
One on the screen.
Oh, great. You can tune out now if you'd like. Just joking. It's always added pressure when there are experts in the room. But one of the things that we do at Sanctuary is we base all of our work in three pillars: lived experience, so listening well to the stories of others, psychology, and theology. And so whilst I'm not trained in psychology, say for an undergrad, I do have some learning in theology. So that's really the lens with which I bring today. And also my lived experience. So the God who sees us. I fell pregnant 2 years ago. It's a little bit like Sarah and Abraham. She was old, I was old. I was 42 and my husband was 50. And it was in the midst of COVID. So I guess it was 3 years ago. He's almost three now, doing the math in my head. I had recently received the COVID vaccine, and I thought I was having some ill effects from it. I was feeling not great. I was really tired. I had my gastro issues. So I went to the doctor, and he was like, oh, interesting. You're experiencing some side effects. Well, let's do some tests. So they ran a plethora of tests. And at the very end, they said, we're going to do one more test, and then we're going to prescribe you some medication. Great, bring it on. Fix me, doctor. And he ended up doing a pregnancy test. And to my surprise, shock and awe, 8 years after my last son, I was expecting a child. And in the midst of this, there was many different factors. I was working with an incredible team, some of whom were experiencing great infertility, some of whom had lost a baby. And here I was with three sons who I had finally got them all potty trained, all talking, walking, and they could all ride a bike independently. Life was good. And I was being faced with an interruption of life in the midst of life. And I had a hard time with it. I was finally back working full time. I hadn't worked with the first three, so this was a total shift in my experience and my identity. I began to see myself as what I was doing, not just as a mother. And it was a hard pregnancy. It was an exceptionally hard pregnancy. I had started at Sanctuary as a full-time team member the day before I found out I was pregnant. So Dan was the second person to know. I told my husband, then I told my boss, which seems totally natural looking back on it, not really. But I started working on a product, on a resource called When a Loved One Dies by Suicide. And in my role as producing that resource, I was traveling across the US interviewing people who had lost someone to suicide. And I sat across from them, I wept with them. And in the midst of that, my own mental health started to languish. I was experiencing panic every time I got in a car. I would sit in meetings with my hand on my chin, hoping nobody noticed that I was just checking to make sure that my heart was still beating. I would shake myself to make sure that I didn't pass out because I could never feel like I was getting enough oxygen. My then 8-year-old son looked up at me one day with his big blue eyes and said, "Mom, why does God make it so hard to have a baby?" And I said, "Oh, it's hard, but it's beautiful." So in that midst of that time, I was so greatly supported by Sanctuary and my teammates and my understanding of mental health, which had grown significantly through my work with them. But I also was waiting for an answer, waiting for a solution. And my midwives were great, and they eventually did recommend me to a psychiatrist at the St. Paul's Hospital in the reproductive mental health ward, and that was wonderful. But at one point, I was in Dallas, Texas, and I had just sat with an incredible man who had told me how his daughter had died by suicide. And he spoke about it, and I cried with him, and I excused myself, and I went up and got to the bathroom and wept alone in the bathroom. And I came back, put on my game face again, and we went to the airport. And we got to the airport, and what should happen? The flight was canceled because of a tornado warning. Now, take an anxious person who has panic attacks and then tell her that, guess what? There's a tornado coming and you have to get on a plane. Oh, I was not in my finest moment. And my friends and colleagues were sat at the bar in the airport drinking beer, thinking there's not much else we can do. And I was pacing up and down the hallway, not knowing how I could get home. It wasn't until I Googled how many hours it would take me to drive from Dallas to Vancouver that I thought, I have to get myself together. I have to find a way to get on this plane. And my colleagues called me over as I was pacing up and down, and they said, "Brianna, look, there's a nun." Now, I need to caveat that by saying I grew up in the Catholic Church, and as the token Catholic on our team, anything that resembles Catholicity, they're like, "Brianna, go." So, "Brianna, there's a nun." So I looked over, and there was indeed a nun who was dressed in the habit of Mother Teresa's order, so the Sisters of Charity, and it was easily recognizable to me that she was from Mother Teresa's order. And I thought, oh, I mean, perhaps this will be the distraction that I need. I'll go over and talk to her. So I went over and I asked two questions. "Oh, where are you coming from? Where are you going?" And we began a conversation. And friends, in three sentences, she looked at me dead in the eyes and she said, "Brianna?" And I said, "Cecilia?" She said, "Well, it's now Mary, Sister Mary Thomas, but yes, it was Cecilia. She was one of my youth group kids when I was a youth pastor 12 years prior in Calgary, Alberta. She was waiting to get on the same new flight as me to Calgary. And when we got on that plane, and I did get on, there was an extra seat beside me. I had the whole row to myself. And Sister Mary Thomas came up and sat with me and prayed with me as I panicked through that flight. The God who sees us. That was not the solution to my mental health journey. It was just a part of it. God showed up in the medicine bottle as well. But the God who sees me saw that moment and gifted me the greatest gift, presence. In the story in Genesis that we read this morning, it's an incredible story, and most commentaries focus on the story of Sarah and Abraham in salvation history. What an incredible story. That Abraham bears two sons and they become these two tribes. It's an incredible story. But what I'd like to focus on actually is the subtext. This small and insignificant woman, she's considered a minor character in the Old Testament, but she is the first person in the Old Testament to give God a name. She is the only one to give God a name, Elroy, the God who sees me. So, what do we know about Hagar? We know that she is a used and abused woman. We know that she has no power. We know that she is seen and valued for what she does, not because of who she is. She is a woman whose best purpose is to bear Abraham a son. So, what's interesting in this context is Abram, then Abraham, and I'm just going to call them Abraham and Sarah because it gets confusing. So, I think we'll cut our losses and just call them Abraham and Sarah from the beginning. Abraham shifts in this passage that we read from listening to the voice of God to listening to the voice of Sarah. And in that voice of Sarah, he takes Hagar and impregnates her, and she bears a son. Now, if we look at the cultural context of this time, the worth of a woman was her childbearing capacity. And so in that moment, that power dynamic doesn't shift significantly, but we can understand when it says that Hagar, now pregnant, starts to disrespect her mistress, Sarah. I'm more valuable right now because I'm bearing a child and you are not. And so there's a shift in the dynamics there. And Sarah finds that contemptuous. How could you mistreat me? I am your mistress. And Abraham washes his hands of the whole situation and says, do what you want with her. This is your problem. And so she mistreats her. And we don't know the context of what that mistreatment looks like. We do know how slaves and servants were treated in those times contextually, and it wasn't pretty. So we imagine that mistreatment is significant, and it means that she was debased even more. And Hagar, knowing only her value for what she produces, escapes into the wilderness. I've had the occasion to be in the Holy Land a few times. And I was most surprised when I took my three older sons to the zoo in Jerusalem, because there were lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, they had real predators in that time in the wilderness. So when we think of it these days, we think, oh, she just went out into the desert. Maybe there's some nice trees. Actually, it was very tree-y. That's not the right word. There was a lot of forest. And she went out at the risk of being consumed by the predators in the wilderness. But that near certain death was a better option to her than staying and being mistreated. So we know it must have been bad. So there she goes and she stops. She stops by a spring of water. Well, why is that important? Because that is a source of life. She stops at the source of life. And if we extrapolate that, we think this life within her, who is the source of that life? She stops at that knowing, at the source of life. And there, the messenger, the angel of the Lord appears to her. And this is really interesting because I didn't really think this through until I did a bit more study around the passage. The angel of the Lord is synonymous with divinity, with God himself. When we think about it, in Jacob, in his wrestling with the angel of the Lord, that is God he wrestles with. And at the end, he says, I have seen God. Moses, burning bush, messenger, angel of the Lord. When he finishes, he says, I have seen God. Hagar, in this moment when the angel of the Lord appears to her, doesn't say, I have seen God. She says, God has seen me. What a shift. But as she sits there, and as the angel appears to her, there's a few things that I think we can notice in that. The first is that the angel of the Lord says to her, Hagar. He calls her by name. And this is important because he says, Hagar, servant of Sarai, or Sarah, as it will be. And he unites her purpose and her personhood. In all the other descriptions, we either hear her name or we hear her utility. But the angel of the Lord unites the two. He sees her for who she is, and in calling her by name, restores her dignity and her value as a person first and foremost, and unites her utility with that. And then he asks her two questions. He says, where have you come from and where are you going? Do you remember what I asked Sister Mary Thomas in the airport? Where have you come from and where are you going? It's a really great opener. It's a great conversation. You can ask somebody in the street, where are you coming from? Where are you going? It offers a lot. But here's what we note in this passage. Hagar cannot answer the second part of the question. She can only say where she's come from. She has no vision of the future. And so the angel of the Lord speaks to her and says, what you have is a return. And this is what gets me kind of irked, because it's not an exciting answer that he gives her, right? Like, he doesn't say, don't worry, everything's going to be better. And we're going to make sure that she doesn't abuse you anymore. No, he says, you're going to go back. You're going to have a son. And he's a wild ass of a man. I mean, I would have loved some sort of disclaimer around my teenagers if the angel of the Lord had said that to me, so I could have been prepared. But that's what he says to her. And yet there's one difference. He doesn't remove the suffering. He doesn't paint a picture of her that it will be beautiful and it'll be mountaintops, but he does tell her that the presence of the Lord will be with her. And so she goes back. She chooses to go back, not with the understanding that things had changed, but only with the understanding that God was with her. The God who sees me, the God who knows me, and the God who promises to be with me in presence. If you note that this is Hagar's, not her last encounter with El Roy, the God who sees me, she escapes to the wilderness once more in Genesis 21. And in doing so, she has run out of water. She places her son Ishmael, who, interestingly, Ishmael in Hebrew means God saves, or God hears, pardon me, God hears. And Hagar places him under a shade, the shade of a bush, and runs bow's distance away. So probably a kilometer, we would imagine. And she cannot bear to see her son die. And in that moment, she cries out to God, and God hears her lament and saves Ishmael by once again living water. So there's this interesting beginning and end of Hagar's story that both takes place in a God who sees and in a God who hears. Recognizing our time, I'd like to think about not only the God who sees us individually, but what that means in community. Gabor Mate, who does great work in addiction recovery, he says that safety is not the absence of threat, but it is the presence of connection, what it means to be connected in time. So let's turn to Luke then. And why did I choose Luke? Because obviously this is also in Mark and Matthew. But I have a soft spot for Luke in the as a gospel writer. So he tends to give voice to the marginalized and emphasizes women's stories a little bit more than Matthew and Mark. So I just chose his version of it. They're basically all the same verbatim, but I love this story. And typically when you go into this gospel reading, you're going to say, "Oh, look at that disconnect between the Pharisees and the people in the room. The Pharisees are like, Jesus, why did you heal? And why are you saying his sins are forgiven? Why not just say, get up?" And so Jesus does say, get up. But that's not what I want to look at today. I want to look at the other part of it. So we know that Hagar was used and abused, and she met the God who sees her. And in this story, we have a paralytic man. We don't know much of his story. We know that he is paralyzed, and we know that he has good friends. But I'd like to take a moment to imagine with you what that means to be those good friends. Do you think he said to them, "Hey guys, I hear Jesus is in town. Can you lower me down through a roof?" Or do you think they said, "Hey, we love you so much. We see that you're affected, that you are in a place where you can't move and you can't bring yourself into the presence of God, but maybe we could help you." If you've ever, worked with a board and had four people on each corner of it. I used to do this activity when I was doing leadership training, and we would tie strings to each four corners and we'd place a ball in the middle of the board. And we would ask the people to work together in order to lower the board to the ground without the ball falling off. Sound easy? No, so difficult. So I'm assuming that this man on the stretcher being lowered down must have had an awful lot of trust in his friends. Because here he is on a stretcher with four guys holding the sides and being lowered in. So the first thing to note is we don't know the circumstance. We don't know if he asked or if they volunteered. But we do know Jesus's response. And this is so key, and it seems to get lost in so many readings of this gospel. So I'm going to just return to it here. So, when they could not find a way to do this because of the crowd, they went up on the roof and lowered him on his mat through the tiles into the middle of the crowd, right in front of Jesus. When Jesus saw their faith, when Jesus saw their faith, not the faith of the paralytic man, not the faith of he who had been lowered, but their faith. It was a communal faith that Christ hearkened to. He said, "Friend, your sins are forgiven." In that moment, we understand that the sins of forgiveness is actually understood in this space as being the return of the presence of God. Because sins in the Hebrew tradition would have separated you from God. It would have allowed you, it would have disallowed you to be in his presence. So in that moment, the presence of God is close to him already. Rupture and repair. It is first and foremost the relationship that is repaired. And then he says, well, it's easier to say, your sins are forgiven, get up, and he walks out. I wonder what he did with his friends. Remember, his friends are probably still on the roof. His friends aren't in the presence of God made flesh, God incarnate. His friends are up high, looking down. Do you think they felt begrudging that they didn't get to meet Jesus? In celebrity status these days, right? Like, if my friend tells me that, oh gosh, we just met, I don't even know who's famous. This is going to totally age me, but I already gave away my age, so it's okay. But we met Tom Cruise. I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan, but I once was, maybe. If my friend said, oh, we met Tom Cruise and he gifted us this huge gift, and I was like, I drove you there. You know, it was me who got you there, and I get nothing. But that's not the position. We hear no more of that. We know it was their communal faith that participated in bringing a person into the presence of God. Friends, I'm at time, but I want to conclude by placing this in the lens of mental health. We know that sometimes, like I was paralyzed by my mental health challenge, that we know that everyone has mental health. Just like we have physical health, we all have mental health. And there will be seasons of flourishing, and there will be seasons of languishing. And the two messages from the scriptures today remind us of two key things. First, that God sees us in that languishing. That what matters is not whether we are mended or we are repaired, but that God is with us. And the second thing is that our community participates in ushering us into God's presence. We speak in terms of mental health in something called the continuum, the mental health continuum. It's based on the work of Dr. Corey Keyes, who is a sociologist and psychologist out of the Pacific Northwest. And he did extensive studies around what it meant for people to be flourishing or languishing in their mental health. And what he discovered is that for people who had been diagnosed with severe depression, if they had a community around them, if they had therapy and perhaps even medication, their mental health could be flourishing. That is to say, they could be able to roll with the punches of life, be happy, access joy easily, and thrive. Whereas people who had no mental illness diagnosis, but didn't have those same pieces in place, would be languishing or could be languishing. And so, what he suggested was that if we understood mental health as a continuum, perhaps even quadrants, on the vertical, you would have languishing or flourishing and languishing. And then you would, on the horizontal, you would have with or without illness. And everyone is somewhere in that continuum because we all have mental health. And in our lives, we will probably fluctuate on where we find ourselves in that moment. But where is God? God is the circle around. God holds all of us in that. And a good community will say, if you are in an experience, if you are experiencing languishing with or without mental illness, we are present. We are with you to remind you of God's presence. I was in Australia, and I'm going to close with this, to cast a vision. You don't know this about me, but primarily I'm an artist, and so I see in pictures. And I want to leave you with an image that I hope is helpful to you in this conversation. I was in Australia, and at this time I was with four boys. So the youngest was only one then. His name is Jericho because we say God tore down the walls of our heart with him. And so Jericho would wake up. He was jet lagged, and we were jet lagged. And I would wake up every morning before sunrise. And I started to notice something really interesting. The birds in Australia, and I've since witnessed this phenomenon here too, but it's just we have to have sunshine and we don't have that often. The birds would start singing about an hour before sunrise. And I couldn't understand it. I was desperate to understand how these birds knew that sun was coming. Like, it's pitch dark out, it's still cold, there's no warmth of the sun. How do they know? But they start singing. And so I started doing some research, as I'm wont to do when I don't understand something. So many days later, I discovered that this phenomenon was called the dawn chorus. And biologists have many different reasons for it. Primarily, they suspect it's to do with mating and the louder voices attracting of the males attracting the females in the morning sun. But there's one biologist, and I like him the best. He says that there is another theory, and that theory that is in birds that are members of a flock. Some of them during the night get cold, and some of them during the night get hungry. But other members of the flock are warm and have been well fed. And those members of the flock that are flourishing, who have had no trouble during the night, are signaling to the birds of the flock who are languishing and desperate for the heat of the sun that it is coming soon. Let me say that again. The flock is singing to their companions that light, that dawn is on the way, that the warmth of the sun will hit them again soon, and they will be able to forage. Our hope is that at Sanctuary Mental Health is that the church becomes that voice, that dawn chorus for each of us when we are languishing or when we are flourishing, that we recognize that in community we can usher in the presence of God for others. Thank you for your time and for your patience, because I did go over.